going to be looking at Ecclesiastes, and over the last few weeks, well, I guess we missed last week because we had Jeff's class on Israel that we looked at, and before that, we were just beginning to look at what are the effects of the fall, the fact that we live in a broken world. How does this affect the tasks that we set our hands to during the day-to-day lives that we run? And so we're going to continue looking at that, this tension between the dignity and the goodness of God's call to work, and then also the fallen reality that we all experience. And particularly today, we're going to focus on this notion of the futility that we all experience when we work, the pointlessness, the meaningless of it. And what better way to jump in than to look at Ecclesiastes, which, if you've never read the book of Ecclesiastes before, is all about wrestling with the meaning of life. So I think this is, interestingly enough, we saw, what was it, Salieri and Mozart, right, in the play Amadeus. And last time we saw that it was Salieri's lack of skills, the fact that he could envision more than he could actually do himself, whether it's in his own latent talents or lack of talents, or in the just the resistance in the environment around him. He was experiencing frustration, and he could see what Mozart was doing and just how jealous in some sense that made him. But today we're going to be looking at, even though you may actually, we all probably can envision the work we want to do and can't do it, but even if you could today envision the work that you wanted to do and accomplish it, even those in the very, very small percentage of the world who actually get a taste of what they long for, even that leaves meaninglessness and frustration. This came clear to me in college. The campus ministry that I was working in, or I was not working in, I was just got to be a part of. It was one of the most brilliant college ministry strategies I've ever seen. So it was college golfer, and it was a ministry called College Golf Fellowship, and their whole strategy was, are you familiar with them? No. So, yeah, I mean, it was like specifically and very much targeted at college golfers. And the way they went about it was they would bring in, they would have these retreats maybe three times a year that household names, I mean, folks especially that college golfers knew of, because they longed to be just like them, but folks you probably have heard of, Davis Love III, Jonathan Bird, Webb Simpson now is somebody a little bit younger, but these folks who were Christians and professional golfers who were very accomplished, I mean, major championship winners, they would host as many college golfers who wanted to come for free in their homes. So you could show up in their homes and go play golf at these like amazing facilities that, you know, they belong to. And it was a free weekend to basically get a glimpse of the life that you always wanted. And they would bring in speakers from across the country, and they'd do the like morning or evening talks, I guess, after playing golf. And inevitably, every time that they would give a talk, it would be a testimonial at some point from the professional golfer who would say, you know, all of you, it's kind of sad, all of you really want, in some ways, what we've accomplished. And I can tell you firsthand, it never delivers what it promises. It never actually satisfies that thing that you long for the most. It's a pretty powerful testimony to be in that environment. And there's a little bit of that. That's exactly what we see in Ecclesiastes. So we're going to do a deep dive into Ecclesiastes this morning. And I'm hoping there's some Bibles in the pews. I don't know. Let's go to Ecclesiastes. It's in the wisdom literature. So it'll be after Psalms. Psalms is kind of like right in the middle of the Bible. And whoever gets there first, just shout out the page number. 574. After Psalms and Proverbs. Song of Solomon. All right. So we're going to do a bit like what we did last time. We're going to read the first two chapters. So it's a good bit of reading. And I'd love for us just to go around. But we're going to look at this in general, and then kind of zoom in into what it says about our work. So does somebody want to start us off? Let's just read kind of read a paragraph or two, and we'll just pick up and we'll go through the first two chapters. So somebody start us in chapter 1, verse 1 of Ecclesiastes. Go for it.
Ecclesiastes all in there. Verse 1. The words of the preacher of the son of David, King of Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil of which he toils under the sun? Generation goes, generation comes, the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down, and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around the north. Around and around goes the wind. And on its surface, the wind comes. All streams run to the sea. The sea is not full. The place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. Man cannot utter. The eye is not satisfied with the season, and the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be. What has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in age before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be.
Go for it.
I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I apply my heart to seek and search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything which is done under the sun, and behold, it is vanity and the striving after the thing. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. And said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had a great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom, and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but striving after wind. For much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow.
I said to myself, come now, I will make a test of pleasure, enjoy yourself. But behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my mind how to cheer my body with wine, my mind still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works, I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and I had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got my singers, both men and women, and many concubines, man's delight.
So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart for no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. And I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had spent in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun.
So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. And I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart, that this also is vanity. For of the wise grievous to me. For all his vanity and his striving after it, I hated all my toil, in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I was leader to man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or cruel. Yet he will be master of all which I toil, and use my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity.
There is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can enjoy, or who can eat, or who can have enjoyment? For to the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he gives the work of gathering and heaping, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and is striving after the wind. This is the word of the Lord. And thanks be to God. So anyone, I know a couple of you have read Ecclesiastes before. And anyone, just by show of hands, who's read it? Okay, great. It's an amazing book. It's one of the, in the Old Testament, there's kind of a group of books called wisdom literature. Psalms, Proverbs, Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes being one of them. And it's different from those other books in a pretty interesting way. Even I wanted to read those first two chapters so you can kind of get a feel of what this author of Ecclesiastes is like. Because unlike these other books, Proverbs, for example, or in the New Testament, a book like James, which is kind of like sitting down with a counselor or a pastor who gives kind of direct advice on how to live. I love what Tim Keller said about this. He says the author of Ecclesiastes, he's like a philosophy professor who provokes you with thorny Socratic questions and strange case studies, who pulls you into dialogue in order for you to find the truth yourself. This philosophy professor of Ecclesiastes, he pushes you to look at the foundations of your life and to ask the basic questions that we might otherwise avoid. Is there any meaning to life? What am I really doing it all for? Why is there so much wrong in the world, and how will I cope with it? It's a really great book, and it's a balance, because you would think in wisdom literature it's all about finding wisdom, but even what you've noticed, hopefully you picked up on these first two chapters of Ecclesiastes, is that there's a middle way that this, the preacher, or the, in the Hebrew it's called Kohelet is his name, and it can be translated preacher, or teacher, or philosopher even. And so that's the one who's speaking here. And what he's saying is that, well, I applied my heart. One of the things he says is the search for purpose and wisdom, or the search for purpose and meaning. He looked into this area of wisdom, and even that had its limits. And so one of the main points of the book of Ecclesiastes, we have to understand this phrase called under the sun. That comes up over and over in the book. And under the sun refers to life in this world considered in and of itself, apart from any greater or eternal reality. The quest of the philosopher is to have a meaningful life based solely on what can be found within the confines of the material world. And so hopefully you've picked up on, even in the first two chapters here, there's three ways that he goes about finding purpose and meaning. He says ultimately that all three of them are meaningless under the sun, that is, apart from any sort of greater eternal reality. You'll notice in verses, do I have this in your handout? The kind of structure of these first two? Yeah, perfect. So you'll see this first way that he goes about it is the meaninglessness of wisdom. In the chapter 1, and then there in verses 12 through 17 of chapter 2, he talks about applying himself for learning, for wisdom, and he says, even this great man of wisdom, that it was vanity, that it was meaningless. Another way that he applied himself to find meaning and purpose was in self-indulgence and pleasure in verses 1 through 11 of chapter 2. And that's not too often that you'll, or it's not too rare that you'll see this same kind of trajectory. Folks who apply themselves maybe to learning, they go back and forth between these two poles. Whether you start out in life trying to to gain wisdom and knowledge, only to find it has its limits, and so you go to purely self-indulgence and pleasure. Or maybe you've been someone like a prodigal, and then you go to the other end of the spectrum, and you focus on wisdom. But either way, both of those is meaninglessness. But what I want to zoom in on this morning is specifically verses 18 through 26 of chapter 2. That's the meaninglessness, not just of wisdom, the meaninglessness, not just of pleasure, but also in our work, in our striving to achieve the things that we set our hands to. And there are a couple things I want to point out. Look at verses 18 through 21. What it says there is, he says, I hated all my toil in which I had toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool, and yet he will be a master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This is vanity. So even right there, what you see, one of the major concerns of work is what happens when you're done with it. The first thing that we see about the meaninglessness in our work is that the sands of time are sinking. We're all going to die, and then what with our work? You see, death and history are the great equalizers of our work. They put it in perspective that really, in the grand scheme of things, under the sun, they're pointless. Even the greatest men and women in the history, by and large, are forgotten. One day will be forgotten. The very work itself, I just spoke to somebody this week. They do a lot of programming. They type in code, and he goes, that code is more or less pointless in a matter of weeks in his specific line of work. Talk about futility, the frustration that we experience in that. There's a great example of just how even some of the greatest works that we can do will eventually be destroyed. This book, Rembrandt is in the Wind. Anybody ever read this before? I read it just a little bit ago. It's a great kind of survey of art and art history. And one of the greatest works, Michelangelo's David, right? You think of this great, majestic sculpture in Florence. And I have to read this because this gets at the futility and of the longevity of our work. And he says this, there are cracks in David's ankles. For more than 500 years, nearly 6,000 pounds of marble have been pushing down on David's legs, and yet he stands. Through centuries of sun, rain, and tremors of thunder, more than a few attacks by vandals, one happened as recently as 1991, where somebody took a hammer to his foot, apparently, chipping off his toe before he was wrestled to the ground. It wasn't police, it was actually other people in the museum who tackled this vandal. Despite all of those things, David still stands. The comprehensive strength of his stone legs has held. But David stands on a bit of a tilt. You know, the picture, can you bring into your mind what David, the statue, looks like? Okay. There's torque to the pressure his weight puts on those tiny fissures. Torque requires tensile strength, of which marble has very little. In almost immeasurable ways, those fractures are growing, working their way up David's legs. This deterioration cannot be reversed. Moreover, Florence itself sits near a fault line that sends tremors through the city. And as the city develops, construction equipment shakes the earth, and as daily queues of tourists form outside the academy, footsteps of a million pilgrims per year from all over the world create an almost immeasurable but nearly constant seismic activity around the statue's base. One day, David will fall. In all likelihood, he will, ironically, be taken down by a stone. Not by the force of a stone that's flung at him, you know, he's holding a sling over his shoulder, but by the limitations of the very stone from which he is carved. You think about some of the greatest works in history, including David. If we were to accomplish one of these things, the inevitability is that they will be brought to nothing. Eventually, there will not be stone left upon stone. And that's one of the realities that we have to face. It's one of the discouraging things under the sun that the prophet, the preacher, the philosopher of Ecclesiastes, he says this is one of the reasons work feels meaningless, is it takes away our hope for the future. But it doesn't just take away the hope of the future, it also robs us of joy in the present, because our work, its meaninglessness in a sense that it's we're alienated both from God and other people. Think about Salieri, right? When he's coming to grips with Mozart's talent and how frustrated he is that he doesn't have this sort of thing. Listen to what he actually made this prayer to God. He said, "Whilst my father prayed earnestly to God to protect commerce, I would offer up secretly the proudest prayer a boy could think of. Lord, make me a great composer. Let me celebrate your glory through music and be celebrated myself. Make me famous through the world, dear God. Make me immortal." That was Salieri's prayer to God. You can already hear right there the just how out of whack his relationship with God and with his work and with others is by this disproportionate relationship with others. He asked God to make him immortal, to become great. Now, there's a fickle thing with ambition, because ambition in and of itself is not a bad thing. I would say if you're actually neglecting trying to do something great, that's equally as sinful. But the motivation behind the ambition is the telltale sign. If you're trying to make your own name great, that's where, if you're trying to become immortal like Salieri, that's where ambition has gone mad. And you also can see just how agonizing in his own story. This is idolatry. This is making something that was a good thing. You know, his gifts in music, he wanted to make them an ultimate thing. He wanted them more than anything else. This desire to be really, not even the gifts itself, but to be, did you hear it? To be recognized by others, to be famous was what his heart wanted more than anything else. And that's idolatry. Whenever you make something an ultimate thing other than God. And what is the result that we have to grapple with is when we live into our idols and when we live according to idolatry, there is inevitable sorrow and pain and vexation. Notice in verse 22 and 23 of what Ecclesiastes says. "What has a man from all the toil and strain from which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of pain, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his mind does not rest. This is also vanity." That's what he's getting at there. There's a sense in which when we look to work, to have it be, you know, under the sun, when we look for it to be something for us that it was never created to do, it's going to inevitably cause pain and frustration. And I think there's a contrast that the author wants us to pick up on. When you think of the very beginning, when God created and he was working, what did he do on the seventh day? He didn't have vexation. He didn't have pain. It was an enjoyment and a rest. You can't help but think also of Jesus, who can sleep in the midst of a storm, that there's this sign of, there's tranquility in the kingdom of God when we are approaching our work in the right way. So work is meaningless because we are all going to die. We have to face our own limitations and mortality. It's meaningless in the sense of our relationships, both with God and with others. We can become alienated in our work. And also, thirdly, work is often unjust and depersonalizing. Later on in Ecclesiastes, chapter 5, verse 8, it says, "If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, don't be amazed at the matter." I think that's kind of interesting. You see injustice in your workplace. Ecclesiastes says, don't be amazed at that. He says, for this reason, "For the high official is watched by a higher official, and there are yet higher ones over them." Now, in the Ecclesiastes day, it was just the government that was kind of the only bureaucracy. And I think we certainly have, I think there's a sense that we can really relate to this in our own government. But it's not just that. Any kind of system, any sort of corporation, you're going to have, as it gets bigger and bigger, there's a bureaucracy. And you start to experience some of the frustration that you can see here of injustice and the depersonalization of work, simply because in the somewhere getting lost and made the, all the hierarchy is a sense of justice, a sense of personal fulfillment in the work. And this became quite evident. This became on a massive scale with the Industrial Revolution, where all of a sudden now you have factories with crazy work hours and sweatshops where you're literally just a cog in the machine. And though we've changed, I would say, from the Industrial Revolution's economy, we have now become a knowledge base or a service base or a digital kind of economy. And that's helped in alleviating some of the problems of the Industrial Revolution and the work environments. But this same sort of frustration, the feeling of you're just a cog in a machine. I mean, people who, Keller mentioned this guy, Mike, who his whole job was working with steel parts. And what he would do is he would take these parts off of the rack and he'd dip them into a vat of paint. And that paint bonded their surfaces together. And then he lifted them out and put them back on the rack. And that was his job, the whole thing. Imagine doing that day after day, year after year, the purposelessness, right, and all of that. And even if that's not what your work is, my hunch is you know something of that feeling of why, you know, whether it's entering data into an Excel spreadsheet or if it's the same thing that seems so pointless, you know probably something of that experience, right? So even though we've shifted from an Industrial Revolution sort of workplace, we all still experience this sort of alienation from the fruit of our labors. We don't experience often firsthand the ultimate goal, the ultimate product. And if you do, God bless you, that's a joy and that should be celebrated. But he poses the problem like this. You know, for a banker in a small town making mortgage and small business loans, that sort of person can easily see the purpose and the fruit of their labor just because they're in a small town. They're going to probably see the fruit of their work play out around them. But a bank worker who's bundling thousands of subprime loans and buying and selling them in enormous blocks of capital will have much more difficulty in answering the question, what is your work for? Right? So as soon as the corporation becomes bigger and bigger and you become further separated from the actual finished product and the tangible fruit that you can see, you're going to experience more of what Ecclesiastes is saying, this futility and frustration. It can be often unjust and depersonalizing, but it also separates us from the fruit of what we long to see. There's another thing that makes work meaningless and frustrating, and this was, there's so many good quotes, I'm going to have to quote, read again here, from David Brooks, who writes in the New York Times. I don't know if anybody heard of David Brooks. Okay. So he wrote an article in the New York Times that outlined a Stanford professor's discussion that he had with his students about their career choices. And it was a fascinating article, even more fascinating, the discussion. And David Brooks, he wrote this. He said, many of the students seem to have a blinkered view of their options. There's the, on the one hand, the crass and affluent investment banking. That's like the real, you know, glitzy kind of work choice. And then there's the poor and the noble nonprofit world. Those are kind of the two poles that people tend to see themselves going in. And then he said, well, then there's another, a third. There's this world of high-tech startups, which magically provides money and coolness simultaneously. But there was little interest, he says, or awareness of things like the ministry, the military, the academy, government service, or the zillion other sectors. Furthermore, few students showed any interest in working for a company that actually makes products. That was pretty interesting. He says, community service has become a patch for morality. Many people today have not been given vocabularies to talk about what virtue is, what character consists of and in which way excellence lies. So they talk about just community service. In whatever field you go into, you will face greed, frustration, and failure. You may find your life challenged by depression, alcoholism, infidelity, your own stupidity, and self-indulgence. Furthermore, around what ultimate purpose should your life revolve? Are you capable of heroic self-sacrifice, or is life just a series of achievement hoops? You can devote your life to community service and be still a total schmuck, he says. You can spend your life on Wall Street, however, and be a hero. Understanding heroism and schmuckdom requires fewer Excel spreadsheets, more Dostoevsky in the Book of Job. Isn't that a great quote? Like, it makes me want to go read the whole article that he wrote in the New York Times. But his point is that students, they're not choosing work that first suits their abilities or their talents, their capacities. Rather, they choose work that sort of fits into their already limited imagination of how they can more often than not boost their own self-image. And you notice the three kind of jobs, right? You've got the financial kind of investment banking world. You've got that provides like a lot of money. It's glitzy. You have the noble nonprofit, and then you also had the sort of high-tech startups, which were just kind of cool, I guess. But he said there's no longer, this is the real kicker, it's why we spent so much time in the first few weeks. He says there's no longer an operative consensus on the dignity of all work. There's still less on the idea that in all work, we're actually the hands and the fingers of God serving the community. If we were to recover that, we would actually have a far more robust set of options. So it feels like, in some ways, they're limited in their choices because you kind of have those three buckets that you have to kind of go into. But if we have a more robust understanding of work, hopefully we could recover work that then would suit them better, necessarily, for the way God has made them and, frankly, what a society needs to operate well. So, this is a really important thing that Keller notes. Given all of that, how should we go about choosing the work that we set ourselves at? I think that's a question we all ask, right? Well, he says, if you have the privilege, the luxury of many options, the first thing you should consider is which work you can do the best. That goes back a couple weeks ago to the competency that we have in our work. But he said also, choose the work that will also benefit others. That's a little less black and white, I think, because we can look at all sorts of jobs that, to a larger or lesser degree, will benefit other people. You can do things like interior design, which really does benefit people in a serious way. But when you look at the example that he gave, was folks in really high-end economies that are making a pretty penny because of high-end, you know, on the commissions they make on high-end interior design, you really start to wrestle with how much of a benefit am I doing to the community and society. So it's less black and white there, but so find work that you can do well, find work that truly benefits others. But then this is a really often neglected point that Dorothy Sayers makes. We don't want to simply just do work in those ways, but we want to also find the work that will benefit the field that we're in as well. Benefiting the very sphere and the kind of work that we find ourselves in is a really good way to, if you can go about doing that, that's a helpful way of choosing the kind of work that God may have you go about doing. So this is Dorothy Sayers. She says, the popular catchphrase today is that everybody's duty is to serve the community. But there is, in fact, a paradox about working to serve the community, and it's this, that to aim directly at serving the community is to falsify the work. There are good reasons for this. She says, the moment you only think of serving other people, you begin to have the notion that other people owe you something for your pains. You begin to think that you have a claim on the community. You will begin to bargain for reward and to angle for applause and to harbor a grievance if you are not appreciated. But if your mind is set upon serving the work itself, then you know that you have nothing to look for. Only the reward the work can give you is the satisfaction of beholding its perfection. The work takes all and gives nothing but itself. And to serve the work is a labor of pure love. The only way of serving the community is to be truly in sympathy with the community, to be oneself a part of that community, and then to serve the work. I think that's a really profound point, because the work itself serves the community. So the worker must devote themselves entirely to that work, trying to benefit the field that they find themselves in. Does that make sense, that point? Of serving the work, not just trying to use the work as of benefiting others, and not just because you're good at it, but you can actually make the work itself better for those who are coming after you. Yeah.
Would it be, say, a medical professional inventing a new tool or a new procedure as a way to fix something?
Right. Yeah. I mean, or a mathematician developing a new theorem. So all these things, you're. This is one thing that whatever you think of PhD work, I guess today, but you're trying to just do a little bit to further the ball downfield, pretty much. All right. So summing up, how can we then? Hopefully, you're thoroughly discouraged at the work right now and how meaningless. Yeah. Ecclesiastes is actually a very optimistic book, despite everything I've said. And we get a glimpse of that optimism. In chapter 3, verse 22, we see, let's see, where's that? He says, "So I saw that there is nothing better than that a man should enjoy his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him?" So he actually says, you know, I think this, was that what you quoted? Yeah, that's what you quoted in the first week. There's a goodness in simply trying to recognize the limits of your work and still enjoy it. But how in the world can we actually enjoy it? Well, verse 13 of chapter 3 gives us a glimpse. It says, "It is God's gift to man that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil or all his work." It's a gift of God. It's by grace. And so how can we take hold of this gift that God offers? Well, go to Ecclesiastes 4 and look with me here, if you would. Ecclesiastes 4, verses 5 and 6. Somebody want to read that?
"The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Better is a handful of quietness than two handfuls of toil and a striving after them."
Right. So there's kind of three ways that you can go about your work, in a sense, and this is paraphrasing those two verses. On the one hand, the fool is simply one who just folds his hands, who doesn't work at all, who doesn't have any sort of, you know, he's not trying to grab anything with his hands. He's simply folding them, and he has nothing in them. So there's no toil, and that is one approach, and that what does it say in verse 5, eats his own flesh. Anybody else have a different translation? We all have the same one.
I take it to mean that starves the body, consumes itself.
That's right.
Literally, physiologically.
That's right. Yeah, I think that's what it's getting at, is that there's a futility in that, and it's a striving after the wind. So there's the empty hands. There's also, you have in the verse 6, two hands. And the image there is somebody who is striving after with all the ambition in the world, trying to gain wealth and possessions and everything. They're trying to strive with all that they are and toiling with all their might to achieve everything they can and accumulate wealth. And that also is folly. It's a striving after the wind. And so what he says is better one handful, a handful of quietness. The image is not no toil, because that won't lead. Basically, if you have no toil and all tranquility, there's not going to be any satisfaction. And if there's all toil and no tranquility, you know, two hands full of wealth striving after the wind, there's also no satisfaction. The only way is to have this balance of both toil and tranquility, having one hand of quietness. That's the image that he's saying there. And so practically speaking, how do we achieve that balance? Well, we have to recognize, we have to name the fact and renounce this tendency that we all feel to make an idol, to make that ultimate reason for our existence coming from our work, whether or what we long our work to provide us, you know, status, recognition, money, power. We have to renounce that tendency, but also we have to put our other relationships in the proper place. We have to approach them from God's wisdom, right? And that may probably mean that we make less money than we could, because you could always make more money and strive with all that you are and ruin all of your relationships. You could find the kind of jobs that don't care about the other aspects of your life, but we have to be willing to not just go after the money, the acclaim, the power, but to strive for healthy relationships as well. And then finally, looking ultimately to Jesus for the thing that we can be so tempted for our work to provide for us. And that is rest and satisfaction. And this is how he ends the chapter. Without the gospel of Jesus, we will have to toil not for the joy of serving others, nor for the satisfaction of a job well done, but to make a name for ourselves. And that's what we'll look at next week, is the tendency, specifically going to the Tower of Babel. We'll look at that. We'll look at actually the book of Esther as well. And what does it look like for us to not try to work in order to make a name for ourselves, but to do it out of a healthy, a holy ambition? And so we'll conclude next week with this several series now of looking at why work isn't the way it should be and why things kind of go haywire and why it's frustrating. So I'm excited to finish up that part, and then we'll close out our time with a few more weeks looking into, well, how does the gospel change how we can mitigate some of the frustrations that we feel? And we'll look in that in more detail. Any questions that you have as we close up, or thoughts as we've looked at this? I've got some questions here for you to take home and to consider in your own lives. Yeah?
What is that quote that you have up there?
Yeah, so this was what I was reading from. Rembrandt is in the wind. It's actually, we have a group meeting in the church right now that's, I forget their name, but it's basically a group that is all about beauty. And they're reading through this book. It's a book by Russ Ramsey. And as somebody who, I guess, I remember going through, I don't know, art history in high school and college and stuff, and I just talk about just doing the work to try and get a grade. I did not actually care about the work itself. And here I am later in life coming to try and appreciate. And it did a great job of situating both the why these things are beautiful, giving a kind of a story of each of the artists, both not sculpture only, but all sorts of art. It gives a bit of their biography, their story, and it does a wonderful job of connecting it to the gospel and what the Bible, the spiritual significance of these works of art and these artists' stories. So I commend it to you if you're interested. It's helpful. Any other thoughts? Okay. Let me pray for us and we'll dismiss. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the honesty and the directness of a book like Ecclesiastes that challenges us. It gives words to the things that we experience in life. And we thank you that at the end of the day, we don't just live under the sun, apart from a greater eternal reality, but that you are the God over all things and that are intimately involved in the day-to-day details of our lives. Lord, as we experience frustration and futility and purposelessness in our work, we ask that you would help us to connect the dots with the gospel, and that we would be willing to make courageous steps to find more fulfillment in our work, to enjoy our work, even if it goes against the stream of the world around us. And we thank you that your word, your paths, lead us to flourishing. So help us with that in this endeavor. And be with us this day as we seek to honor you, to strive with all that we are, not for our own gain, but for your honor and glory, and to serve those around us. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.